Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Michigan Literary Network Radio for Wednesday, March 9th, 2016. I'm Andrea Daniel, and today we're talking the future of employment, identity, and personal satisfaction with award-winning journalist and multimedia reporter, storyteller, and author Farai Jadeja, whose new book is The Episodic Career. Farai Jadeja has combined media, technology, and social political analysis during her 20-year career as an award-winning author, journalist, professor, and lecturer. She is currently a distinguished writer-in-residence at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute, as well as a senior writer covering politics and data at ESPN's 538. She has given thousands of speeches and hosted hundreds of events around the globe. With knowledge, deep knowledge, in a variety of disciplines, including work, politics, culture, race, and technology, Jadeja frequently appears on public radio and cable television, commenting for ABC, BET, CNN, Fox, HBO, MSNBC, NPR, and other media. Moderating a Democratic presidential debate in 2004, Jadeja is also the former longtime host of National Public Radio's News and Notes. Born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, Jadeja graduated with a BA from Harvard University, where she was elected Chief Marshal, the highest honor accorded to a member of the graduating class. She lives in Brooklyn, New York. And I had the wonderful opportunity to interview Farai earlier today because she wasn't able to be with us live. So let's take a listen to that interview with Farai.
All right,
today.
So Farai, welcome to Michigan Literary Network Radio. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastically. Thank you for having me on.
You are so welcome. Okay, so there's the episodic career. Can you give us the definition of the episodic career, the occurrence?
Yeah, so the idea coming from a family of black folks who were farmers, you know, independent farmers in Maryland and Virginia who were essentially self-employed and did pretty well considering the racial climate, who moved into later doing civil service jobs, you know, quote, good paying jobs in the government for Social Security, Water Department, education, in the city, whatever, in Baltimore. The episodic career is none of that. It's basically that you don't have a good-paying job, but what you do is you move around from field to field, getting well-paid, hopefully, but not counting on anything being a career track per se as we know it. And so the idea is that you have to be flexible, adaptable, that you have all these skills, and at any point in your life, you may have to retrain to take new work. You may have to say goodbye to something you loved that was a field you were happy in but that is not making money anymore. And it's about being someone who can flow and evolve and change and also be aware that you can retrain yourself for new opportunities.
Okay. That's a mouthful, and so many questions just jumped off of me from that. That is an occurrence that some of us are not necessarily used to, given the climate of the way the job market was maybe 10, 20 years ago. There's a little bit of a shift that has happened. Talk about the shift.
Yeah, so I think as, you know, I'm from Baltimore, and I think if you are from Detroit or many other cities in Michigan or many other parts of America and the world, you know that the economy has changed. So in Baltimore, when my mom was growing up, the city had nearly 1 million people. Now it has 600,000. That means property tax revenue has gone down. The schools have to fight for money, all sorts of things. And at the same time, in addition to other issues like politics, white flight, urban economics, you also have across the country and across the world a move towards globalization of jobs, meaning anyone, anywhere could potentially do almost anything. There are some exceptions, but you're not competing as a man named Alec Ross, who has a great book out now called Industries of the Future, said, you're not competing against people in you know, Baltimoreans are not competing against Philadelphians, they're competing against Bangalore, India. And and that's true both ways. Bangalore is competing against us for who has the most favorable job market. And automation, which, you know, has been a big factor in the auto industry, in technology, but even in things like healthcare and education, and drugstores, like, you know, walking into a drugstore and seeing a kiosk instead of a human. Automation means that there are less jobs for human beings. So all of that puts us in a place where we have to decide, where are there jobs for human beings? How long will those jobs last? Like, do we see this as a career track we could stay in indefinitely or not? And even if we see it as a long-term career, do we have the ability to retrain and rethink as this career changes? Because nothing is staying the same. And people, I mean, even something like agriculture, which you think, oh, well, you know, it's growing food. Of course, it's growing food. But there's so many things that go into agriculture. There's, you know, business acumen about who to buy products from to, you know, till your fields and to use fertilizer, pesticides if you choose to, all these things. Like, even, you know, what we consider essential jobs, caring for children, can also intersect with digital technology. Like, do you have a nanny cam? In what cases and where? Like, is a daycare willing to put their video online? And in some cases, we see cases of kids locked overnight in places, and there's video of it because of the shift in what caregivers are expected to do.
Right.
So everyone is touched by technology. Everyone is touched by globalization. And our labor market is unstable, but I would argue, and I do argue in my latest book, that there's still opportunity, especially for people who understand what's going on. If you don't know what's going on, you're going to have a much worse time.
Right, right. So now let's keep moving and talk about The Episodic Career, the book. How did it come to be, and what's it made of?
Yeah, so this book came out of me doing political reporting, which I am doing for this insane election, and I've done for 20 years. I've never seen an election like this, but I also feel very strongly that people who have been paying attention to issues of race, class, and jobs understand where all of this vortex has been coming from. That said, I traveled around extensively in 2010 looking at communities that were preparing to vote in the midterm elections where the Tea Party was ascendant. And so I went to Tea Party rallies. I went to progressive activist rallies about housing discrimination. I met with all sorts of people about how they viewed their choices. And jobs were such a big part of it. Can I get a job? Where can I get a job? Do I have to move to get a job? What's going to happen to my family if I don't have a job? And then I started just doing more and more research, traveling more and more around the country. I had people in my book from pretty much, you know, all over the country representatively, and did a lot of original survey research. And my question was, how can people prepare themselves to be employed? And that's much more practical. A lot of my journalism is more, I wouldn't say theoretical, but more just sort of like, this is the way this works, this is the way that works, here's these cultural things. But this one is really saying, okay, you probably need a little bit of a survival guide to how to stay employed, and I'm going to write that book because how I'm going to write it is different from other people are. So the first part is macroeconomics, like what's happening with the economy now in terms of globalization and what's called disruptive innovation, which often leads to, you know, either a blend of human talent and machine talent or automation of certain jobs. And then I get into a self-diagnostic tool, the work-life matrix, which really allows you to map yourself on a continuum of employees in terms of what you really want. And then I get into the last two parts of the book deal with the current and future realities of work. So current things like hold 'em or fold 'em, like when do you leave a job and how do you leave a job? And then the last part dealing with issues like retirement and what is the future of retirement when some people are working into their 90s and other people get unemployed in their 50s and can never find a job again right when they need to save. So mm-hmm. I get into, you know, all of those issues.
Wow. So is it for mature job seekers or is it for new job seekers, like for someone coming out of college?
The target audience is people, I would say, in their mid-30s all the way through 60s. But a lot of people are giving the book to millennials as kind of a, here's what's going on. And I do have people of many different ages. Like the youngest person I interviewed for this book was 22 and the oldest was 92. So I'm not restricting myself based on age. And the 92-year-old in the book is now 94. And because I interviewed her, I became friends with her. So we spent Valentine's Day together, she, my sister, and I. She's a full-time educational national parks ranger. She's been honored by President Obama. She's African-American with Louisiana ancestry. Who her family moved to Northern California after the Great Flood of 1927 when the levees were, of course, you know, positioned to drench the black neighborhoods to save the white neighborhoods. And she has a very interesting race, class, political analysis about her whole life. And she's still working because she believes she still has work to do. There's no question she could just be kind of chilling, but she's an active person, and I mean physically and intellectually, and she's someone who really believes that she has things to do, and that keeps her getting out of bed every day.
Wow, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is one of the ones, one of the stories.
And
that
her name, by the way, is Betty Reed Soskin, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. She's one of the. That's one of the stories I wanted you to talk a little bit about, because that her being 92 and still working. That's like you said, she could be just chilling, but she still feels like she has work to do, and that's a different kind of mindset. Because if she's set up to just chill, but she chooses to work, that says something. You know, that's a motivation for so many other people. Like, we all have so much more work to do.
Right, and she's getting paid for her work, but there are a lot of people, there's a whole movement that I also discuss in the book called the Encore Careers Movement, which is primarily to get people who have formally retired to do service. And my mother would fit into this category, although she hasn't participated in anything formally in terms of that. But she tutors, she does work at the Arboretum, she does work with the Community Association. And I think increasingly we realize, if we are blessed enough to have good health, that we're not meant to, you know, stop our work, you know. And it doesn't even have to be outside the home. I think that my grandmother, who was very active in many different things, and she was a writer, and she had worked as a person in corporate America for a while, not corporate America, but in government, and help desegregate her office, kicking and screaming. She was someone who always gave back just by being the person in our family who nurtured all the grandkids and nurtured her extended family. So there's a lot of ways to stay active, but I think a lot of people don't want to be sidelined, and they don't want to be told that their usefulness is over at a certain age. Mm.
Right, right. So when you started traveling around in 2010, interviewing everybody, was it the intention at that time to do this book?
No. I was doing a completely different project. But, you know, inspiration comes from many different things. And for me, it was inspiring to talk to people who were trying to figure out how to survive in an America that had increasingly become hostile to their interests. And here I speak, to be honest, in some of the early reporting, a lot of the people I met who were the most disappointed were white Americans who felt that the American dream was dead. And there were also many black Americans and Latinos who felt that, you know, their lives had dead-ended, but they were how to put it, not a surprise. You know, I think that there was a certain surprise among some particularly working class white Americans and rural white Americans that this country was in as much distress as it was, because it had been hidden a little bit from the majority of the population, whereas in other parts of the country and with other demographics, it was clear we were going through a big thing. So I think this whole decade of ours, where today real family wealth is less than it was 10 years ago, that means if you bought a new TV, if you bought a new vacuum cleaner, if you want to send your kids to college, your household is probably earning less money now than it did 10 years ago in inflation-adjusted terms. And inflation has not been a big issue in America. So people have had to tighten their belt. They've had to deal with credit up and down, sometimes losing a house. Other people have done quite well, but there's a lot of people in this country who are having sticker shock about the cost of living in America because they haven't seen their salaries rise. And, in fact, the opposite. And so there's a lot of social discontent and psychological discontent that goes with feeling that you're potentially trapped. And so I get into a whole lot of psychology. I get into the physical nature of the human body and how it deals with stress. And I make an argument that you have to take care of yourself in these very profound ways in order to deal with the stress of the modern economy, because it's not a calm situation. It's a taxing situation.
That's very practical advice. And you also talk about in the book that we're living in an age of rapid disruption where realities are always changing. And you mentioned that a little bit first off, but talk a little bit more about that perspective as it relates to careers and work, because we are seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like I grew up, like I said, in this family where a lot of people ended up getting civil service jobs, which were they were a mixed blessing. The good part is you had pension plans and this, that, and the other. The bad part was that, you know, in my family's case, racism was a part of the narrative for most people in terms of how they got evaluated and promoted. My grandmother was a bit of a whistleblower about some discriminatory hiring practices in the 70s at Social Security, and she was blacklisted for a while internally, but later got a commendation for her work in exposing how at a certain entry-level test, all of the white applicants were chosen, regardless of how they tested, before any of the black applicants were chosen. And she just said, I'm not putting up with this. And she paid a price and later was rewarded. And to me, that set a very ethical example of how one person can change a workplace. You know, it doesn't have to be the boss. She was middle management, but she just wouldn't let this die. And I think all of us have to choose at certain points what we're willing to do in the context of work. And so this constant disruption means that from a certain understanding of work, which is based on whether it's unions or civil service or just whatever, of work as something you do and you succeed if you do well and you move up a ladder, it's just become more of a constant reinvention of the workplace where one minute New York only has cabs, the next it has Uber. You know, one minute healthcare is primarily provided by people in the same hospital. Now, a hospital can contract out lab results, x-ray readings, any number of things, and you're dealing with people all over the world who may be doing some of the tasks that you start in the hospital. You draw the blood or you get the reading or you take the x-ray, and then someone else might be looking at the x-ray exams halfway around the world. And so there's that, and then there's automation from technology of all sorts of jobs. And so you cannot assume that your industry or job will exist
Right.
And you can also not assume that it will be doing well, but there's always new things happening. And so essentially everyone has to become a detective in terms of figuring out opportunity. You have to figure out, where am I most likely to do well? What are the skills I have? Not rely on necessarily what you've done in the past, but say, I'm adaptable, I can roll with this, I can use all these other skills I have. And you have to look for opportunity, because what's going to be ascendant in the American economy depends on factors that I think no one can predict. I mean, if they could, if the people even in, you know, Wall Street, in the Congressional Accountability Office, or, you know, if any of them could have predicted what happened before the Great Recession, I'm assuming they would have prevented it, you know?
Right.
So you can't be that person, you can't be that person who wants to figure out exactly what's going to happen, but you want to be that person who says, no matter what happens, I'm going to look out for myself, I'm going to look out for my family, my community, and I'm going to be adaptable, I'm going to be flexible.
Right. I love all the information that you're talking about from the episodic career. That's so wonderful. And I want to switch it up just a little bit and talk about some of the other writing that you do, because you, in addition to your nonfiction books, you have Trust, The Color of Our Future, Don't Believe the Hype, but you have some fiction work going on, too. You've got Kiss the Sky, and I understand that you're also working on a new project for the young adults. It's a sci-fi novel about genetic engineering. And so this is you mixing up your nonfiction and your fiction, and I'm imagining that there's some kind of emotional reward in that for you. Is that so?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, fiction for me is like, I always was the kid who was reading, whether it was Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, or, you know, the Ring Trilogy. I was always immersed in fictional worlds, and my mom was like, you need to read more biographies, and she would give me James Beckwith and this and that. And I got stuff out of it, but I really liked fictional worlds, and I liked the idea that for every fictional world, there was a creator. And in science fiction, we've seen some really interesting voices emerge who are Black women or people of color, you know. Tanana Reeve Du is someone who is amazing, and she's written, you know, science fiction, fantasy, and horror novels. Although she's passed away, Octavia Butler is a great model, and people like Nnedi Okafor. So there's a whole movement of, whether it's Black women specifically or women or people of color, who are doing work on science fiction and fantasy. And I think that in some ways it allows you. So the first interracial kiss broadcast on American TV was on Star Trek. And I think that happened for a reason, because first of all, it was, they weren't supposed to be enjoying it. Ha ha ha. It was part of this whole alien mind control thing. But secondly, it was, science fiction and fantasy are a place where you can explore breaking social norms. And so I feel like there's a real political power in recognizing narrative, you know, whether it's fairy tales or popular culture or whatever. Narrative is what people seek out as they're trying to make sense of the world. And it doesn't always have to be real narrative. It can also be fictionalized narratives, but they have their own place. And so I also think that the teen years and the preteen years are a time where people are looking for a sense of how they fit into the world. And I also am a science geek, so I've been asking my friends who are bioengineers to really help me with this story. And I also went to the first international summit on human gene editing, which is a real thing, and happened in December. And basically there's new technology that will allow the human race to evolve ourselves. Meaning we can cut and splice genes the way that you, you know, make a lasagna. Maybe, okay, it's not that easy, but it's there's going to be some interesting stuff happening, you know, where we can control our genetic destiny, but the question is also, who has the money to do it? What are they after? And how does that fit in with being part of a community? But I think in the same way that we have had to accept the many differences that already existed in the human experience, whether it was racial differences, gender, LGBT, trans, we will at some point have to accept as a society that there are people who are genetically altered and there are people who have not chosen that path. And we'll have to figure out how to live together, I hope, or else, you know.
Right. Do you have an anticipated date as to when we can look forward to reading that book?
Yeah, it's done in draft form, but I'm not happy with it. And I it's been done for about 18 months, and I've been taking notes, and I've started rewriting parts of it. But I really believe that good fiction is often when characters speak for themselves. And I think some of my characters are really speaking to me and others have not yet. I don't want to wait forever. Maybe I just publish what I have because it's timely. It's what I'm writing about is very timely to the human experience. But I also believe that I don't want part of fiction is and nonfiction. I mean, I think together, I don't want people to be puppets. I don't want to make the people who I interview, who are real people, tell me what I want to hear. I want to hear what they have to say and then make sense of it. And with my characters, I'm inventing them, but at the same time, you know, they provoke questions to me. So I'm like, well, would that person really say that? Or would they do this? Or how would their house look? And those are really interesting questions.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. That is so wonderful. And I just have so many more questions, but our time is coming to an end. But I know that you're going to be in Detroit later this month. Tell us about that event.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely really excited about coming to Detroit because, among other things, I have God family there. So one of my good friends from college is someone who, you know, I'm now lucky enough to be the godmother to her young teenage daughter. And so when I come out to Detroit, I see it. Just, you know, to let me wax poetic for a second, I see it as a place where there is innovation. You know, I don't see Detroit as a place of desperation or a place of failure. I see it as a place of deep, deep, deep innovation. And to me, you know, coming to Detroit is always renewing. You know, I know people who are the Mosaic Theater Company with youth. And so the long story short is that I'm reading at Source Booksellers on the 20th at 4 o'clock. And they're, 4240 Cass Avenue in Detroit. You know, but I'll be staying with my God family and just hanging out, meeting people throughout the weekend leading up to that reading, because I believe that Detroit has a lot to teach us. And I also think the arts community is very strong. And, you know, so, yeah, there's a lot.
Wonderful. Well, that is so exciting. And I'm going to see you on the 20th. And I want to thank you for Rye today for being with us on Michigan Literary Network Radio today. I have certainly enjoyed this interview.
I have too, and I really appreciate talking to you.
Okay, you are so welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. See you later.
Okay, take care. Bye.
Thank you. And that is it for that interview with Farai today. Be sure to check her out at her website at Farai.com and follow her on Facebook and other social media sites so that you can see what else is going on with her as a writer and in her life. She's got a wonderful blog on her website, so check her out. And before we close out of Michigan Literary Network Radio, I want to let you know, our listeners, that this Saturday, March 12th, from 10 a.m. to noon is the Motown Writers Network's second Saturday meetup at the Detroit Main Library, 5201 Woodward, and we'll have our guest,
Tammy Turner talking about networking for authors. And that's it for this edition of Michigan Literary Network Radio. Come on back to Michigan Literary Network Radio next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more literary good stuff. I'm Andrea Daniel. Thank you for being there.